Welcome to Reboot Republic, the podcast that goes behind the headlines and looks at the big stories in this republic of inequality. We are the podcast that looks at the solutions. We are the podcast of hope. I'm your host, Rory Hearn, and joined always by my co-host and alter ego, Tony Groves. Tony, how are you? I think are we 2 years old?
Yeah, we're 2 years old, I think, last week.
Have we got over the toddler tantrum stage?
Well, not judging by the background noise you have there, I think is that your inner child giving us grief? No, I think it's a testament to the fact that you have to keep going. The secret to these things is you keep putting it out into the world and you hope that the mud sticks and enough of the ideas actually germinate and get out there. And they do. They really do. You know, so it's so fair play. We keep going.
Yeah, no, I think we've achieved a lot, and I think, you know, the feedback we get is great, and, you know, we've talked to a lot of really, really good people, and, you know, now more than ever, there's a need for platforms like this to keep putting out, you know, the alternative ideas where there is actually the hope and possibilities of change. So fair play to you too. Thanks, and let's keep going.
Absolutely.
That's it. Okay, so we're joined today by Michael Tass. Michael, you have to excuse the dinosaurs in the background. Michael Taft, Policy Officer with SIPTU. Michael, how are you?
Good. Just hanging in there.
Great. Listen, thanks so much for joining us. Michael, you've done a number of really, really interesting posts, and anybody who hasn't seen them, they go over to Notes on the front. You put them up on Twitter. I'm sure you put them up on other platforms as well, but you have your blog Notes in the front. Some really good posts, blogs are kind of covering with good analysis around, particularly I was struck by your last few, your one on the Programme for Government. Your one on the left strategy, which you wrote an article on for the Tribune magazine. And also then you talk about the state and the state as job creator. Maybe we could run through a couple of those. How does that sound?
That's good. Yeah, that's good.
So the Programme for Government, Michael, then. Do you agree with the analysis that, who was it, Finian McGrath, who called us the left, or what was it, Che Guevara would be delighted with such a left program?
Finian said that it was the most left-wing government ever in the state, and that it was so left-wing that James Connolly and Che Guevara would vote for it.
Would they if they were alive?
I've never read anything by James Connolly talking about a broadly balanced budget or cutting the capital gains tax, you know. So, but maybe Finian has sourced some letters or correspondence or something that I haven't read, you know. The Programme for Government, we're going to get a kind of a discourse on the Programme for Government, which is going to call it left of center or progressive or whatever. I mean, okay, leave aside Finian. That's just, you know, comic relief. More serious commentators are suggesting that the last government was social democratic. The new divide in the Dáil will be between radicals and moderates. Mm. So there'll be an attempt to label opposition or any kind of alternative to this program for government as somehow way out in left field, whereas this occupies what's kind of being called the radical center ground. And therefore, it's an attempt to, you know, to push opposition or to push alternative ideas out to the fringe. But that's the first thing about the program.
Yeah. Okay. So, and what about the detail in terms of, you know, the broad economic strategy within it? And you talked about that in actual fact, like it's not really a major investment plan. It's not really based about an expansion of public expenditure.
Yeah, I mean, to be honest, any government coming in now or any parties, even if it were progressive parties, would not be able to, at this stage of the crisis, kind of put numbers on things or specific targets because it's such a fluid situation. So the fact that it's a bit vague in certain areas, that's not the problem. The problem is those areas where they aren't vague. To give you an example, they are calling for a broadly balanced budget, but they don't give a date or a target. Okay. When you look at their taxation proposals, you find that there is a range of tax cuts that they are gearing up for. And we know that in the stimulus budget, we will probably see tax cuts, maybe temporary in nature. but also some tax cuts like cutting the USC surcharge on high incomes. That's a surcharge of 3% that's paid on incomes over 100,000. They call this unfair. Now, in the list of things that are unfair, I wouldn't put a 3% surcharge on someone earning over 100,000 in that category. They also, you know, are looking to review the capital gains tax with a view to cutting it. So, on the other hand, what we find is that they will increase consumption taxes. In fact, they say that any tax increase will focus on consumption taxes, which by and large are regressive and will hit low-income earners the hardest. But what they won't do is they won't touch income tax, they won't touch USC, they won't touch corporation tax, which are all progressive taxes. So just on that area there, we have some information. It's not progressive at all. And then you look at other bits and pieces. They're not going to look at SláintecAir until budget 2022. So they're kind of postponing that. There's nothing really concrete on that issue. The only positive thing in the program is that they have opened the door to looking at employers' social insurance. We have one of the lowest levels of employers' social insurance in Europe. And therefore, any increase in that, if it's linked to rolling out better social protection benefits, that would be a plus. But by and large, I mean, I think in a lot of areas we're going to have to wait. But in those areas where we do have some detail, it's not very encouraging.
Michael, can I just? It's going to be pretty clear that this will be put out. And like, I spoke to Dr. Aileen Maron yesterday evening, who wrote a paper, you know, 10 years ago about the framing of the public versus private in the media post global financial crisis, about how austerity was considered just a fact, and anybody else who said there was an alternative was, you know, branded a radical or outside of the remit. And now we're seeing that emerge. And in that program, the stimulus package that's coming, they are going to say, well, we're the biggest spending government, you know, every budget will be the biggest spending in the history of the state. And yet, when we saw yesterday, for example, housing, something that we talk about a lot on this podcast, the delivery model looks to be something like enhanced leasing, which their own IG, the Irish Government Economic Evaluation Services, is the least efficient way of delivering stuff. You know, how do we counter that narrative?
Well, first off, I think you have to do it on the basis of common sense. I think that, the parties in opposition, the progressive parties, left of center parties, whatever, what they have to do is, first off, they have to kind of pose the question, does this make sense? And then put forward an alternative which does. I'll give you an example. I mean, housing is a good example. I understand that, I read that the new housing minister is looking to purchase Airbnbs, houses that were formerly under Airbnb, to bring into the public stock. Now, that could be extremely expensive. In fact, we already know that some councils are paying well over 400,000 euros for houses as part of the Part 5 social housing, 10% social housing allotment. So what we're doing, if we go down the route of buying houses that were previously, you know, almost dedicated to Airbnb, is that we're giving a capital gain to owners whose asset now is returning nothing because the market is tanking. Mm-hmm. And we're going to pay over the odds for that. So you ask people, does it make sense to buy a house for 400,000 when you can build it for 200,000? The only answer to that is, well, yeah, but it only takes a few months to buy a house. It takes like 2-3 years to build a house, which is true. But that doesn't mean you commit yourself to an asset purchase, which is financially inefficient, to say the least. So therefore, I think we have to pose those questions like that to people and see, you know, and get their response. Because ultimately, what you want people to say is, well, that doesn't make sense. you know, it's not about left or right. It's not about, you know, the state versus the market or anything like that. It's just that, you know, does it make sense? Again, you come back to healthcare. Does it make sense that if you are ill, what regardless of what it is, but of course during the COVID-19 thing, it was with if you had the virus, doesn't it make sense that you are brought into hospital, treated, and you are not charged for it? So when you pose it in that way, you can begin to take back that famous center ground, if politics even works on that basis. I'm doubtful of that. You can begin to take that and open up space for your alternatives.
But Michael, it's an interesting way that kind of how COVID has, again, like we've seen so many things over the last, you know, few years that have changed our whole, you know, way of how politics is being done from, you know, the emergence of kind of new left politics in Spain and, you know, kind of even referred to as populism, and then the emergence of Trump and Johnson, and now, you know, climate change, you know, made us in terms of look at how politics has been done, and now we have COVID, and it has again changed how we need to look at politics and how we present ideas and what are our responses. And if, for example, like to follow on from what Tony is saying there, asking kind of at a broad level, you know, how do we respond as progressives, for example, to COVID? Like, what should we be doing? I know particularly in the area of housing, there's a lot that can be done, but broadly in terms of the economy, and particularly I'm thinking of the hundreds of thousands of people who've lost their jobs or on, you know, have suffered pay cuts or on short time. And, you know, a lot don't have a prospect of that employment returning. What should progressives be calling for now in terms of that?
In terms of getting people back to work?
Yeah, providing, yeah, or even trying to, we were talking about it a few months ago when COVID, in the initial phase of maybe even possibly transforming our economy through this, like, you know, how do we create proper sustainable jobs? How could we, what should the government be doing rather than just going back to business as usual? Creating jobs that are actually well-paid and sustainable?
Well, I think the first thing is that there is going to be an ongoing process of rolling out subsidies that's going to go beyond just the July stimulus, because this is the first. The government will also be introducing a national economic plans for different sectors, and then there will be budget 2021. And we're likely to see the expenditure levels continue to just to go where they go over the next year and a half. You know, issues of austerity or fiscal contraction or cutting back on things won't really arise until 2022. So we're going to have this period. Now, one simple thing that could be done is that if you are going to take sectoral initiatives, let's take hospitality or non-food retail, which are, you know, very low paid, very poor jobs and all that, the least you can do at this stage is establish sectoral committees with representatives of all the stakeholders to monitor, design, implement these programs, and which have a feedback mechanism which can identify the abuses, the inefficiencies that are occurring on the ground. It's a very simple stakeholder idea, which even IBEC has supported in very ambiguous and vague terms. They're using the term stakeholder. I'm not quite sure they understand what it means, because stakeholders actually means that anybody who's affected by a decision should have participation in that decision. Yeah, and that's a very powerful message. So that's one very simple thing. I mean, there's no lever that you can pull that's going to get everybody back into jobs. But what you can do is get people's representatives, those stakeholder representatives, involved in that process. To give you one example, the last government, one of the last acts that they did was establish this tourism recovery task force. And it was set up by Minister Shane Ross, ex-minister, ex-TD Shane Ross. And he said, you know, this would bring together all the stakeholders in the tourism sector to chart a recovery plan. Well, okay, charting a recovery plan is a good idea. Except there was one thing. The biggest number of stakeholders was excluded from that task force, which was essentially workers' representatives. Therefore, we had a task force which was dominated by employer interests and capital. So we have to fight against the idea that you have all these businesses queuing up down the road, looking for handouts, looking for public subsidies, many of which are valid, by the way, many of which are legitimate, but they have no accountability over what they do with them in their workplace. So, that thing, I think it was the disability campaigners who came up with the phrase, no decision about us without us. I think that would be a good first step and give people the hope that they will have some sort of input, some sort of stake in these decisions and in the way they're made.
Is
there a way of, as I was saying, they're bringing in the idea of, okay, that's one part which is really important, is participation of particularly, the workers who are involved, of employees in responding and designing the response. But also then, what is the possibility of actually, what I was talking about, transforming, our labor market, changing it so that we get a living wage? Is there a way that if we're subsidizing companies, we can put in a clause that, you have to be delivering a living wage, or if possible, or how could that be worked out, for example, to ensure that the subsidies that are going in aren't just being funneled off into profits for companies, but are actually being distributed both into investment, ensuring the business is viable, and into the workers?
Well, I'll give you one example. It's an area I know fairly well because I work with the Big Start campaign, which was set up by the members of SIPTU. These are the childcare workers. And there's thousands of members of SIPTU trade union among childcare, in the childcare profession. And childcare providers are making all sorts of demands. Some of them, again, quite legitimate, because they're going to be facing reduced demands, higher costs because of social distancing, and, of course, the loss of revenue over the last few months in their close down. It's very simple. Maintain the temporary wage subsidy scheme in that sector. In fact, make it permanent, because eventually the government is going to have to take over the payment of wages in the childcare sector, because it's the only agency that can mobilize the resources to pay decent wages. But as an interim step, to keep maintain the wage subsidy scheme, but require employers to top up to the living wage. The living wage has been a campaign among the Big Start. It was in before the last budget, there was a campaign for the living wage to be funded through the budget. And it's a very small cost. It's incredibly small. It costs about $25 million for the state to ensure that every worker in the childcare sector at least was paid the living wage at $12.30 an hour, because some of them are paid as low as $10.50, $10.80 an hour, some even on the minimum wage. So if you go sector by sector, you can say to the hospitality sector, okay, we're going to keep the wage subsidy scheme. And by the way, for the hospitality sector, that is a huge subsidy, because wages make up, 40-50% of the expenditure of restaurants and hotels? Fair enough. I don't mind giving that support. But the requirement should be you have to top up that wage subsidy up to at least the living wage. That could be a stipulation. That could be a demand. Why shouldn't employers, if they are getting something from the public, be required to be accountable for what the public believes is a social good? And it's a social good that everybody, earn at least the minimum essential to have a decent standard of living. So that's one example, and it will be important for the opposition parties in the debate over the stimulus not to get distracted by the percentage points or the big numbers that will come about, but say, how, that's fine, we're going to subsidize business, we're essentially going to socialize them, but therefore what are they going to do in return to assist whether it's the goals for decent wages, decent working conditions, whether they are environmental goals, whether they are social goals, how are we going to set those? How are we going to require them to abide by it? In other words, if the public is going to give you a lot of money, the public gets to call some shots in this. So that will be, I think that will be a turning point, could be a turning point in how the government and the opposition parties view the very nature of stimulus and the very nature of public subsidies to the private sector.
Michael, I have a big digression, but I want to ask you because it's going to be very relevant when this podcast comes out shortly. Tomorrow, there's a ruling on the Apple tax, and we've already seen commitments to appeal it. And I've seen Nessa Hourigan, the Greens' current finance spokesperson, saying that you know the decision to appeal it would not be good at this time. But, you know, are we mad to be sitting here having this conversation about needing to top up these things when, you know, this is going on in the background, or is tax justice just something that we're just going to have to accept that's part of our economy?
Well, I mean, first off, the decision that will be delivered tomorrow will be the General European Court.
Mm-hmm.
Whatever happens, it will be appealed, whether the appeal is upheld or turned down. And Apple is a party to that. So if it goes against them, they will be able to appeal it to the European Court of Justice, regardless if the Irish government does or not. So I think we have to anticipate that there will be an appeal to the European Court of Justice, and it'll be another 2 years. So, however, the court decision tomorrow will be important because if it goes the right way, which is the progressive way, in other words, Apple, you know, should pay for the state aid that they received. If it goes that way, then that will be an important marker. That will be an important indication. The European Court of Justice doesn't usually overturn a finding in the General European Court. So if it goes our way, we would, in all probability, be looking at getting this $13 billion plus the interest in about 2 years' time. Now, of course, other governments will be able to come in on that, because one of the reasons why the Irish government benefited from the, or the Apple benefited from the state aid, was because they were able to shift profits from other countries, which should have been legitimately taxed there. Mm-hmm. So it could even be further on. But the wider question of tax justice, let's be very clear. If we want tax justice, if we want big tech firms to be accountable to the sovereign tax bases, if we want to bring some accountability over the way the multinationals act, Ireland will be the loser in terms of corporate tax revenue. There's just no way out of that. It will take a hit. We already are over-reliant on corporate tax revenue. That's one of the silver linings of being a tax haven. You get a lot of corporate tax revenue. Ourselves and Luxembourg, you can look at the amount of tax revenue they receive as a proportion of their economy, and you can see that. So we're already over-reliant. Tax justice across the board, whether it's a digital tax or consolidated corporate tax base, whatever it might be, that will mean that we will lose out in terms of billions of euros of revenue. Not likely to lose out, by the way, on jobs. Not likely to lose out on the basis of FDI, because we still have a 12.5% tax rate, which would still be beneficial, you know, in key areas. But we just have to accept that. Now, there are some progressive parties that are not in favor of the consolidated corporate tax base, not in favor of digital tax, because of the fear of the loss of jobs and the loss of revenue. So we need to debate that, and that's going to be a very difficult debate among progressives.
Isn't that one of the main reasons, well, to my mind, I'm going to say it's one of the main reasons where Pascal Donoghue found himself as president of the European group? Because if you saw who voted for him, it was the Benelux countries that saved the day in terms of and there was a lot of that comes down to, you know, let's tell the truth, Ireland and Luxembourg are the main culprits here. The Netherlands aren't too far behind in some of their dealings, and Belgium haven't got clean hands. I'm not saying anybody has clean hands. I'm simply saying that, you know, the others, this is, and Pascal has already spoken about not wanting, you know, the CCTB, the Common Consolidated Corporate Tax Base, and Ireland asserting its will on that. So I suppose, you know, is this where the game is at now in terms of this? Is this going to be stifled, any moves now for that on the basis of this presidency?
I don't know. I think that kind of plays out on a larger pitch, but I think you're right to point that out. There's also probably other currents. I don't think there's one reason why he won. There's other currents. I think just a lot of smaller parties wanted to gang up on Germany and France and Italy, the larger states. There's a lot of things that you know cut across those issues. So there's not one particular reason. What is interesting is, and this hasn't been commented much, is that this kind of looks like an abandonment of the diplomacy that Donia was previously expressing about a new Hanseatic League.
Yes.
We ditched that Hanseatic League, which basically included like very frugal countries like Netherlands, etc., when we supported the Mediterranean countries over the issue of the EU Commission issuing mutually supported bonds.
Yeah, the idea of Corona bonds, kind of.
Yeah. So, you know, that diplomacy, you know, the Hanseatic League has kind of fallen by the wayside. I always thought it was kind of a, you know, an interesting intellectual kind of thing that he was putting out there. But I didn't think it had any real substance because our interests in many respects don't coincide with many of what the we call these frugal countries. Mm-hmm. So there's probably a number of reasons. All things will be judged by what the Eurogroup comes out with. And the key things in the years ahead, not only the accountability of multinationals, but to reform the fiscal rules. Mm-hmm. They've already been suspended. They were the most nonsensical things you could introduce in terms of, you know, regulating your public finance. So to reform, when they will be reintroduced down the line, that they are reformed into something much more rational, and to maintain the supply of liquidity, especially in the event if the ECB does start cutting back in a few years' time, which they will have to, but which I think they will continue for quite a while, because they know the gravity of the situation. We're not the only ones in massive deficits or debts. I mean, the EU Commission is projecting that our debt level is going to only increase at the level of Germany and Sweden. And these are two very, you know, prudent countries, if you will. So those two things, to ensure a rational approach to fiscal rules and to ensure continued liquidity, that will be the basis upon which we judge his actions by.
And Michael, and just in terms of to bring our discussion to a close, I think it's so good to talk to you as always. You had also a piece on the strategy for the left in opposition. And I was really struck by your idea within it, because obviously, aside from, and in a way, COVID has kind of to a large extent overshadowed the significance of the political significance of the formation of the new government, that for the first time we have a left party being the main party of opposition in the Dáil since the early part of our history of this state, that with Sinn Féin being the leading opposition party, and that is very significant, Fianna Fáil and Fine Gael coalescing together in a government, supported obviously by the Greens as well. But that what it means now for the opposition, that if it actually wants to become a left government, and if we don't want just to see, you know, Sinn Féin plus Fianna Fáil or Sinn Féin plus Fine Gael in the next government, if there actually is to be a broad left government, that the opposition has to be seen as a government in waiting. And what that means is actually behaving like that, working together, putting across progressive policies. And of course, we've seen a number of the parties in opposition not working like that from the outset in their opening speeches, even criticizing each other. But what do you see as the kind of, what you can maybe outline your main kind of point you're making around that, and what do you think should happen? What approach the parties should take to actually make that shift from being in opposition to form the next government?
Well, yeah, I mean, the first stage in becoming a government is to look like you are the government. Is to act like a government. That's why they call it a government in waiting. So the first thing is again to capture these common sense, this common sense ground, this idea that people can say, well, yeah, that makes more sense. Secondly, and I was struck by a finding of the Labour Together report, which was a post-election report put together by Labour Party people over in Britain. And they used extensive polling to form some of their analysis. And they found that when the individual policies of the British Labour Party in the last election from their manifesto were put to people, people said, yeah, we agreed with that. Whether it was on social care, free broadband, nationalisation of the railways, when they individually looked at these policies, they said, yes, we agree. But when taken together as a whole, they didn't believe them credible. In other words, there was overreach. That people felt that, you know, it just was not a credible set of policies, unlike the 2017 British Labour Party manifesto. So I think what progressives have to do is not fall into the trap of maximalism or not enoughism, if you will, by attacking the government, saying, well, they should have put this amount of money in, or they should put that amount of money in, or and, you know, demanding, you know, what is kind of what people would say would not be credible. For instance, I know a lot of progressive parties would like to see free public transport. That would be a great idea. We actually, in Dublin, our bus fares are twice the level of those in other European capitals. So there certainly is an argument for drastically reducing public transport fares. But the actual priority is to increase capacity. There's no sense in having like free or cheap public transport if, one, there's not enough buses, not enough trains, and you're going through a city at like 5 miles an hour. So people would recognize that. You know, they want a workable public transport system. Free childcare would be good, but affordable childcare, people would kind of agree with that. In other words, we mark out the direction that we want to go, saying that we're, you know, in the first 5 years of progressive government, we're not going to get everything we want. And we mark them in key areas that really impact on people's lives. Single tier health service is a clear one. Childcare, public transport, job quality. And what I'm talking about that is removal of precarious, you know, removal of precarious work conditions, everything from the hospitality sector to the education sector, collective bargaining, to give people a chance to bargain on a more even ground with their employers. So you pick out key areas and say, this is what we're going to do for the first 5 years.
And obviously housing as well.
Huh?
Obviously housing as well.
I always assume everybody knows that housing is a big issue, and then I go on and talk about that because and again, a very commonsensical approach. You just go down and ask, go do a vox pop down the street and ask people, doesn't it make sense for the state to build a house and then rent it at cost to people so that the state is not a loser, but people get a benefit of a much reduced rent? And people say, yeah, rent it at cost. That's a good idea. Now, cost rental is not a very sexy name. We've got to find something that's a bit more, you know, attractive and a bit more hit. But when you ask people that, people say, yeah, well, that's a good idea. Now, it's doubtful you're going to build 100,000 houses in 5 years. But I don't think people care if it's 100,000, as long as the market is improving, as long as they see that this is a government that is on their side and is moving in the direction. They will excuse the government if it takes a little bit longer to achieve it, as long as they're going in the right direction.
But what about the actual progressives working together, the opposition? Well, do you think that's important?
Absolutely. Listen, if you can't work together in opposition, people will rightly ask, how in the world are they going to work together in government? Mm. And if they're at each other's throat in opposition, it'll be easier in the next election for either Fianna Fáil or Fine Gael to isolate one or two and co-opt them into their government. So working together is absolutely essential. There is no progressive government without a progressive opposition. Now, it's going to take some time. There's a lot of rivalry and all that. I think this is where civil society organizations can help mediate this. certainly the trade union movement, providing a safe space for activists and elected officials from all the political parties to come and just to talk outside the glare of the wider debate. So, you know, for civil society organizations to create a safe space for these people, for people to come together and have a debate, have a discussion, and then have your row. I mean, you know, have, you know, this is, well, we think you're wrong, this is a better way to have that. But outside, not to do that, you know, across the floor of the DAW, or to do that on the public airwaves. Because at the end of the day, I think there's a very good chance of people seeing saying that this could be a serious government. Look at the kind of spokespersons that Progressive has. Is there anybody better than Owen O'Brien on housing? Hmm. Roisin Shorthall pretty much wrote the book on Sláintecare. Jed Nash has been very strong on things like labor rights. Breed Smith has been very good on climate justice. So, you know, already we have spokespersons who can more than carry their weight in debate and have real credibility among people. That's how we can build a progressive government around, through cooperation, through dialogue, and through supporting the parties when they pursue, say, policies of particular interest to them with the strong spokespersons that they have.
Michael, that is really, I think we might leave it there on that note of optimism and hope. Thank you so much again for joining us. It's always great to chat to you. And again, I'd encourage people to go over to your notes in the front blog, have a read. You're pumping out some great stuff, so keep at it. And thank you for all that.
Congratulations on the 2 years, and let's hope it's an even better 2 years ahead.
Well, let's put it Cheers. This way. If we want to keep the progressive stuff going, we need people to put their hands in their pockets and go to patreon.com/tortoiseshack. Give us the price of a cup of coffee. We keep these shows on the road. Talk to you all soon, folks. Thanks. Bye-bye.